Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 269. This is being recorded on January 14th of the year 2001. It's titled Way Too Much Monkey Business, and that title is a reference to not only the contamination of the polio vaccine with a deadly cancer-causing virus, the SV40 or simian virus 40, but apparently that is not a thing of the distant past, in that they are continuing to genetically, and that is the powers that be, the medical powers that be, are continuing to genetically engineer monkeys so that they can test human diseases on them, and that is something that has led to some very, very nasty things indeed. Now, in the past, I've dealt with the subject of genetic engineering, biological warfare, the accidental and or deliberate contamination of vaccines with deadly viruses, cancer-causing viruses, and the HIV, and that is a subject to which we will be returning. There are many broadcasts that are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. That is available at, those tapes are, can be viewed, descriptions of same, viewed on the web at spitfirelist.com. And I've talked about genetic engineering, biological warfare, the contamination of vaccines, accidental, deliberate, and on many broadcasts in the past, and we will be returning to that subject right now. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that was researched for us by Robert Schnitzer, the CEO and executive producer of Oasis TV in Los Angeles. This particular article comes from the Yahoo Asia News of Thursday, January 11th of the year 2001. This is an Agence France-Presse article, Dateline Paris, January 10th. The article is titled, Aussie Scientists Stumble Across the Doomsday Bug. The article reads as follows. Australian gene engineers accidentally created a mouse virus that kills every one of its victims by wrecking their immune system, a discovery with the potential for making the ultimate terrorist weapon, New Scientist reports. The killer bug was invented quite inadvertently while the researchers were trying to create a contraceptive vaccine for mice as a pest control, the British Weekly reports in next Saturday's issue. That would have been, by the way, yesterday, January 13th. Continuing. They inserted into a mousepox virus a gene that creates large amounts of interleukin-4, or IL-4, a naturally occurring molecule that produces antibodies in the immune system. The idea was to stimulate antibodies to destroy eggs in female mice, thus making the rodents infertile. Mousepox, a close relation to smallpox, normally only causes mild symptoms among the type of mice being used in the study, and was only being used as a vehicle to deliver the IL-4. But when the IL-4 gene was inserted, the engineered virus ran amok, attacking the cell-mediated response, unquote, the part of the immune system that fights viral infection. All the animals in the study were wiped out in just 9 days. Worse, the engineered virus was astonishingly resistant to vaccines. A vaccine that would normally protect these mice from mousepox only worked in half of the mice exposed to the killer version. Co-researcher Ron Jackson of the Canberra-based institute CSIRO said the discovery was a frightening indicator of what could happen if the human smallpox virus was similarly modified. Quote, it would be safe to assume that if some idiot did put human IL-4 into human smallpox, they'd increase the lethality quite dramatically, unquote, he told New Scientist. And again quoting, seeing the consequences of what happened in the mice, I wouldn't want to be the one to do the experiment, unquote. It's surprising how very, very bad the virus is, said Ann Hill, a vaccine expert from Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, Oregon. Smallpox has been eradicated as a disease thanks to a global vaccination campaign, although two laboratories, one in the United States, the other in Russia, still have ampules containing the virus under an arrangement with the World Health Organization, or WHO. The incident highlights how easy it could be for some with bioengineering knowledge to create a murderous virus for which there would be no cure or effective vaccine, New Scientist said. Quote, vast amounts of time and effort have gone into policing the military's use of biotechnology, but the activities of civilian biologists have been ignored, it said. Again quoting, yet genetic engineering techniques are now so widespread that potentially dangerous results are bound to emerge accidentally, unquote. It suggests tougher vetting of research proposals, a greater effort to train students in biological subjects about potential dangers arising from lab work, and encouraging greater openness among biologists to discuss the misuse of genetic engineering. That's a very comforting article indeed. In the past, we've talked about the connections between the National Cancer Institute, its special viral cancer research program, Litton Bionetics, and the National Cancer Institute's Molecular Oncology Laboratory, nay, Fort Detrick, the Army's top chem and biowarfare research center. And that institution and the aforementioned special viral cancer research project appears to have been deeply implicated in the creation of AIDS. So when one sees a mouse virus that was, quote, accidentally, unquote, engineered in such a way as to make it much deadlier, and when it's closely related to the human smallpox virus, one wants to think very, very carefully about the implications of that. In the past, by the way, we've taken a look at the hantavirus. That's a rodent virus that apparently jumped species to human beings and was also a major focal point of biological warfare research in the United States. I can appreciate that for newer listeners, in particular people tuned in for the first time, much of what I'm saying might appear to be utterly preposterous. That is why the other broadcasts are available from Spitfire. Check the descriptions on the web or contact Spitfire for more information. Another journalistic reference for the genetically altered mousepox virus. I'm not going to read the article, but one can also find information about that from the Financial Times of London of Friday, January 12th of the year 2001. The article is by Cleve Cookson, C-O-O-K-S-O-N. Headline, Scientists Convert Virus into Killer. In the past, we've talked about not only the probable transmission of the AIDS virus through the experimental hepatitis B vaccination program. I personally think that that vaccine was deliberately contaminated and that it was deliberately tested on people. We've also talked about the contamination of the polio virus with a deadly cancer-causing monkey virus called the SV40 or simian virus 40. In particular, we've spoken with Ed Haslam about his landmark research published in the book Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, which not only talks about the SV40 contamination of the polio vaccine and the probable causality of that contamination of a soft tissue cancer epidemic currently afflicting the United States and other countries around the world, but also links, and I know this will sound fantastic, it also links research into altering that virus in order to produce a vaccine with the milieu of the assassination of President Kennedy. Ed Haslam also discusses the probability or the very great possibility that that research ultimately led to the creation of the AIDS virus, because much of the early genetic engineering research in this country was focusing on the SV40 or simian virus 40. We're going to take a look now at an article that appeared on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle from today. Today, for the benefit of people listening to this program on tape, is Sunday, January 14th of the year 2001. This article appeared on page one. It's the first article of two parts. It's by William Carlson, last name C-A-R-L-S-E-N, of the Chronicle. It's headlined, Quest for the Origin of AIDS, subtitled Controversial Book Spurs Search for How the Worldwide Scourge of HIV Began. And this article reads in part as follows. The longer Edward Hooper studied the maps, the more he believed he had solved one of the great mysteries of modern medicine. He had marked the Central African villages that were home to some of the earliest known cases of AIDS. In a striking number of cases, those villages were near the rural clinics where a U.S. company had tested one of the world's first oral polio vaccines in the late 1950s. For nearly 10 years, the former BBC reporter has been investigating the possibility that something had gone terribly wrong during the vaccination campaign, that a monkey virus had contaminated the experimental polio vaccine and ignited the global AIDS epidemic. It was a theory so troubling, and some say so riddled with flaws, that for years respected scientific journals refused to even acknowledge it. But when Hooper's book, The River, was published in late 1999, laying out evidence for the hypothesis in meticulous detail, the international scientific community could no longer ignore it. What we're going to do in just a minute is to visit once again with the aforementioned Ed Haslam, whose book Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an experimental underground medical laboratory, was published in softcover by the Wordsworth Press and copyright 1995. We're going to be talking with Ed not only about the disinformation that AIDS is decades old, this supposedly from a chimp named Marilyn that turned out to be harbored in a U.S. Air Force laboratory, but also we're going to talk about the book The River. The River appears to contain quite a a few red herrings, and that is a deliberate pun. And the book basically is sort of a literary or intellectual example of recombinant DNA. It takes two very important and very provocative and hypotheses. One, that the AIDS virus comes from the deliberate contamination, or certainly the contamination of the experimental hepatitis B vaccine with HIV, and the certainty that the polio vaccine was contaminated with a deadly monkey virus, the SV40, which causes cancer. We spoke with Ed Haslam, or I spoke with Ed Haslam, on October 29th of the year 2000. We reviewed the information linking the research into modifying the SV40 in order to produce a vaccine with the milieu of the assassination of President Kennedy. And I can appreciate, again, for newer listeners, that might sound utterly incredible. We then talked about a very, very important series of articles that was published in the Atlantic Monthly in February of the year 2000 that shored up Ed's research into the oncogenic properties, the cancer-causing properties of the SV40, the simian virus 40. After discussing those and beginning to talk about AIDS and some of the disinformation that has emerged concerning AIDS, we went into, among other subjects, the aforementioned chimp, Marilyn, and also the book, The River. What we're going to do right now is to access the part of that interview with Ed Haslam. The following interview was recorded for One Step Beyond. That's the program that I do in Northern California on a weekly basis. This is from the One Step Beyond program of October 29th of the year 2000. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of the aforementioned Ed Haslam. To that at considerable measure. Now, one of the things that you point out in your book, Ed, and this is by way of bringing things around to matters of direct concern to people in the audience, you collated some information from the National Cancer Institute and came to the conclusion that there was a soft tissue cancer epidemic in all likelihood traceable to the SV40 contamination.
Well, concluding there's an epidemic of soft tissue cancers is, in my opinion, the only conclusion you can come to when you look at the statistics. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a subtle or gentle or anything else. It is a bold-faced problem which has a line, a statistical line on the graph, which is very similar to the deplorable increase in lung cancer. And the background to this is that all of the other cancers, besides this handful of soft tissue cancers, show a 0% increase over the 16-year period of time. So you've got a handful of cancers that are going through the roof, and I mean over 50% increase incidence rate during this period of time, on a background of the other 32 or so sites that they track, which show a 0% increase over that period of time. So you got one flat line and one line that's going through the roof. And so, you know, what do you call that, you know? The numbers in there, I mean, when you look in, you're talking about 500,000 cases a year versus about 30,000 cases a year of polio during the height of the polio epidemic, maybe 50,000 cases max. If there's a connection between the two, and I think there's some reasonable evidence to make that claim, what you're looking at is about 15 cases of cancer in return for every one case of polio.
One of the points that I want to stress that we have covered in past broadcasts, and due to the limitations of time, we'll not be able to get into at any great length here, that is that two of the cancers that you talk about are cancers of the breast and also prostate. And there's been a lot of publicity. In fact, I think as we speak on October 29th of 2000, October is actually Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Am I correct? I saw an article in the paper about it the other day, so I'm pretty sure I'm correct.
I think it is, and you and I rattled the saber in the bucket over the U.S. Post Office release of a breast cancer stamp without a release of a prostate cancer stamp, and they very promptly released a prostate cancer stamp afterwards. You know, I mean, these are both sexual tissues.
And I would point out that SV40 and or viral particles have been found not only in semen samples, but also in breast milk, too. And obviously the connection between the breast and breast cancer and the semen and prostate need not be elaborated here.
Well, let me elaborate it. I mean, They didn't find 1 or 2% in some bizarre population. That a study done in Italy found SV40 in 45% of the semen of healthy Italian males.
And which also would indicate that the virus could be sexually communicated through intercourse.
Well, it's a possibility, yeah.
One of the things to bear in mind as we discuss this is that both types of cancers are officially epidemic. Now, you also mentioned other types of cancers. They have not been connected to the polio virus in the popular discussion, but cancer of the prostate and breast cancer are well-known, relatively epidemic killers at this point. There's been a fair amount of publicity. One of the things that I wanted to get to briefly, Ed, a lot of listeners may feel helpless in listening to some of this. Obviously, we've covered a great deal of ground in a short period of time, but a lot of people may be wondering, well, geez, that's just one more piece of bad news. One of the aspects of the Atlantic Monthly article that we did not get to in our previous discussion of this, and something that I think holds out a certain amount of hope, and that is that there had been a trial vaccine using a genetically modified product involving something called antisense RNA, which appeared to neutralize SV40 very, very effectively and thus offers very real prospects for a vaccine against these deadly killers.
The idea that there could be a vaccine against it goes back to the 1950s. I was real happy to see what Atlantic Monthly had to say, particularly since they explained it in relatively understandable language in comparison to the technical literature on it. There is hope, you know, but there is no hope unless we understand the issues. There is no hope unless we do something about it. While what we have here is bad news, the good news in it is with some action and with some hope, there's technical stuff that can be done. What I find as difficult is if we live in a state of national denial over the contamination of polio vaccine, and everyone who has real information concerning it is basically concealing that information due to accountability issues, then we will not progress into a deeper level of discussion which will produce real answers for us. So, you know, when I hear things like this debate going on over the river, which was a preposterous thing from the beginning, and all they did was use up all our samples of the polio vaccine in order to test something that had been previously disproven, I wonder how that debate contributes to our understanding of the situation and our finding a solution. You know, I would not be in this debate if I didn't think that the conversation would lead to a solution.
Before we get to the river, I just want to encourage listeners not to take this information lying down, but rather to utilize the information as sort of a self-help course with the prospects of a cancer vaccine looking relatively encouraging with regard to SV40 from these trials of a vaccine using something called antisense RNA. It is altogether possible that with sufficient popular pressure, a vaccine could be field tested and then developed. And this could, to a certain extent, lift this horrendous scourge. I mean, if you think of the people that have died and or lost loved ones to breast cancer or prostate cancer, this is something that could make a huge difference, and in fact a pivotal difference, in the lives of listeners and listeners' loved ones. And I want to encourage in the most emphatic fashion listeners to use an activist/populist approach in connection with the information that you're developing. Having said that, Ed, a book called The River, which mixed a couple of arguments about contamination of the polio vaccine with the development of AIDS, something else you touch on in your book. Tell us briefly what the presentation was in that book and what you think is wrong with the research that's made into the popular press in recent weeks.
Well, Dave, I'm going to zigzag on you. I'm going to ask you to bring up the river here in a minute.
Okay.
But there's something that's really even closer to our conversations and things that I think your listeners will relate to. I came out to the Bay Area at your invitation, and I made presentations over at near the KFJC campus, and on the same campus there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a question asked to me during one of those presentations of, it was a guy in the second row, and he said, "Where do you think this conversation about the origin of AIDS goes?" And in that presentation, which you all tape recorded, I said, I think we have a problem here. I think they have a problem because they have AIDS over here, and they have a monkey virus over there, and they have this big gap in the middle. Okay, and how do they solve that gap? Well, this monkey is not close enough to the humans to make it all work. The explanation has to be some kind of laboratory mishap, whether intentional or unintentional. I think they're going to fill this gap with a chimpanzee. You remember this conversation,
Dave? Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
And it was shortly after that that the conversation in the national press about the origin of AIDS started shifting to chimpanzee. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a researcher by the name of Hahn, H-A-H-N, from Alabama, Huntsville, like University of Alabama or whatever the appropriate organization is there. She had received some samples in the mail from a friend of hers in New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
from Alamogordo, New Mexico, and from a chimpanzee who had died in 1984. And the name of this chimpanzee was Marilyn. And she had inspected Marilyn's tissue, and she had found, positively and absolutely the satisfaction of every scientist looking over her shoulder, she had found HIV-1 in the tissue of this chimpanzee. She called a press conference, and she announced to the world, and it was plastered from coast to coast across the United States, that she had found the origin of AIDS in a chimpanzee. Okay?
Right.
Now, I happen to know a little bit about the laboratory in New Mexico from which she got her sample.
And this is the chimp?
The chimp.
Right.
Yeah. That laboratory, which is adjacent to the White Sands Missile Range and has been run at the bequest of the U.S. Air Force for years, has 600, 700 chimpanzees in it, and was run by a man by the name of Colston, C-O-U-L-S-T-O-N. And shortly after I published my book in August of 95, there was an incident involving New York State University, NYU, where a professor at NYU had admitted to one of his colleagues was trying to cross the sperm of a human with the egg of a chimpanzee. Well, within the week, the lab was shut down.
Mm-hmm.
87 chimpanzees were taken from New York, put on trucks, sent across the country, and a newspaper article appeared in Albuquerque, in one of the two papers here, announcing the arrival of these 87 chimpanzees, which were being turned over to Colston. Okay? This is in August of 1995. In that article, they interviewed Colston. Right? Colston's about 90 years old at the time. He's been doing this chimp lab stuff for 50 years. And Colston says, within months, 2 or 3 months, of the announcement of the discovery of AIDS, meaning San Diego, summer of 1981 and maybe 82 at the worst, but I think it's 81, he had started infecting female chimpanzees in his laboratory with AIDS-contaminated blood from this San Diego incident to see if the disease would be passed between mother and child in childbirth. Okay?
I mean, this would be from mother chimpanzee to offspring.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay. And this event, his description of this occurred in the 1982 time frame.
Okay. That, as far as I know, I don't have the literature in front of me, but that was well before HIV was officially discussed as a cause of AIDS, wasn't it?
That's right. All they knew was there's something in there doing this. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Colston was ahead of the curve. Okay, but he's on record. My point is, he's on record as of August of '95,
mm-hmm.
stating that by the fall of 81 or 82, whatever that year is, that they find it in San Diego, that he has already started injecting his chimpanzees with this stuff, okay? 2 years later, a female chimpanzee in his care dies.
That would have been around 1984?
1984.
And
right.
It was actually in the spring of 1984 that it was first announced that this virus, which they initially called HTLV-3, was identified as a probable cause of AIDS.
Right. Well, this chimpanzee dies. They take cell samples and they put it in a refrigerator in Colston's office. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And 13 years later, after Colston dies, they go in and clean out the refrigerator.
Right.
And they send that sample over to this woman, Hahn, in Alabama. Now, what I'm saying to you, in blunt language, is that the samples, finding an HIV-infected chimpanzee in Colson's laboratory in 1984 proves nothing, nothing.
Right.
About the origin of AIDS, because Colston is on record for admitting that 2 years prior to that, he was infecting female chimpanzees in his care.
And is it reasonable? Had that been discussed in the literature, the Colston revelations?
Because No. This is part of the joy of your radio program. This is how we bring this stuff to market, you know? But it was reported in like 500 newspapers and 20 national magazines coast to coast that they had found the source of AIDS as being a chimpanzee.
And was this the flurry of media attention that located the origin now back to 1930? Was that the same canard, or what am I confusing?
No, that's the exact same stuff, Dave.
All right. So it's interesting, Ed. Dave,
the first threshold was 1960. Remember, I kept pushing it right at 1960, and they kept saying it was 1959, right, with the Manchester semen incident and the thing in Central Africa that I discuss in my book.
Okay.
Then Dr. Ho comes along, and this was, you handed me a newspaper article the day I was in Palo Alto or whatever.
Los Altos,
okay. Mm-hmm. And I went home and read it, and right before my presentation that night. And what I was curious about is, this was Dr. Ho, who receives millions of dollars of AIDS research in New York City, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he was reporting the results of a Dr. Wu from out in Seattle. And I wanted to know, what they were saying was they had found evidence of HIV-1, that related back to the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the older a sample is, the harder it is to determine what's going on. I was really interested in how many of these things they found. I mean, what was the depth of their evidence?
Ed, if I could interrupt ever so briefly, let's continue with the discussion.
And we will indeed be continuing the discussion. This is from October 29th of the year 2000. That, however, will be on the other side of the tape. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 269, being recorded on January 14th of the year 2001. The title of the program is Way Too Much Monkey Business. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.